have not been delivered what was promised at the national level. I mean, I know, and thank God for the great work that was done nationally. Let me give that praise for developing and helping the private sector get these vaccines. But we are at a pace right now to deliver vaccines in Los Angeles over 5 years instead of over half a year.
Mayor Eric Garcetti, speaking yesterday morning on Face the Nation, Garcetti also said that every 6 seconds someone in L.A. County is infected with the virus. L.A. continues to be a hotspot for COVID-19 cases, an average of 16,000 new cases every day since the new year. Hospitals are treating people in gift shops and administrative offices. They're so overwhelmed, and local funeral homes can't handle the demand. They're turning families away. Meanwhile, the vaccine rollout is rolling out slowly. Here in California, around 436,000 people have been vaccinated. That's in a state of 40 million people. Mayor Garcetti blames the federal government for the slow rollout. He says the city and state need more money. But there are also reports that many frontline healthcare workers are turning down the vaccines. And joining us to talk about this, the vaccine rollout, is Dr. Oliver Brooks, part of a team that drafted the guidelines for the state's rollout, and he's the chief medical officer of Watts Healthcare. Welcome back to Press Play, Dr. Brooks. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, the national goal from Operation Warp Speed was to deliver 300 million vaccine doses by January, but the CDC is reporting only about 4 million people have been vaccinated. So why the disparity? Why so few?
So I believe there are a number of factors. First of all, the federal government helped with Operation Warp Speed to get the vaccine developed and through the FDA for emergency use authorization, and then help some with the shipping and distribution, if you will. But there is no coordinated national strategy to getting people vaccinated. So vaccines don't save lives. Vaccinations do. So that last half mile, with the internet getting from the pole to the house, that is having to be done on a state-by-state basis. And so the states have put plans together. But I think really, really importantly, at least for California/LA County, we did not expect to have the vaccine rollout during a surge of patients and those with COVID-19 that we've never seen in the history of this country in terms of a pandemic. The local health department is at capacity. They're still having to contact, trace, test, manage labs. So they're doing as much as they can. So I believe that the real issue is that there's just a lot to be done and not the total manpower to do it. So that concept of resources that was stated by the mayor, I concur with that.
Mm. So is the problem the distribution and not the supply, or is it both?
It's been both. We were promised 2 million doses by the end of December, this state, and we have not received that. We were expecting another 2 million by the end of January, and I don't know if we're going to reach that. So, yeah, there has been less vaccine. And then also in the actual allocation, in terms of it goes to the county and then the county has to distribute it. The county is working very hard right now. I have to say I hear from them daily. But it's a Herculean task. Like, we have to sign up. You have to be validated to be able to give the vaccine. Then you have to determine that the people who are receiving it are, in fact, eligible to get it. Then you have to document what you're doing. So it just takes a lot. Mm-hmm. There's also some relative degree of vaccine hesitancy, and that's also part of the challenge.
Right. As we saw in a report from the LA Times a few days ago, that shockingly, many frontline healthcare workers, I think, at least something like 20% to 40% in LA County and more in other counties are refusing to take it. Does that surprise you?
Well, the way I look at it is this, that those that are healthcare workers generally reflect the population at large. So I believe around 15 to 20%, or let's say 30%, are Latinx. Maybe 10% are Black, African American, and then others. So the same way there is a reflection of vaccine hesitancy, which we've all heard in the polls with different populations, it's just being mirrored with healthcare providers. So a lot of the concerns that the public has, the healthcare providers do. I will say, though, what I'm seeing is that is diminishing. As people are getting vaccinated, other people are starting to get vaccinated. So those that are the early adopters, if you would, a healthcare provider, say, first in line, let me go first, that is influencing those that are, saying, I want to wait a month or 2 months. I'm seeing them get it, wait a week or wait 5 days. There are more that are now getting vaccinated.
What about this idea that's being floated now and in Britain and also here in the United States, that it might be a good idea, given this surge that you mentioned, this unprecedented surge in coronavirus cases, that we just give out the first dose now to as many people as possible and wait for the second dose and not hold back the second dose for the people who are getting the first dose? In other words, spread it out
right.
to more people, but more thinly.
All right. So in other words, give the second dose that you were going to give to the person who got the first dose to someone else as their first dose.
Yeah.
I am not in favor of that. I think that to get fully immunized, you need two doses. But it's the choice of Solomon. Do you which baby do you kill? You can have more people vaccinated with a lower level of coverage, or you can have less people vaccinated with a higher level of coverage. I think that the studies were done and the plans were done with a two-dose vaccine, at least for Pfizer and Moderna, so which is what we have now. So, no, I think that we should go on and give that second dose to those who got the first dose to know that it was managed appropriately. And then as there's more vaccine, I believe there would be less of an issue with that.
But how much are you covered with the first dose?
It's different per vaccine. I don't have the data in front of me, but you're fairly well covered, somewhere in the 80% or so. And again, it's different. I believe that it was with Moderna, you have a higher coverage with the first dose. But right now, I still believe that we should do it the way it was planned. If you got the first dose, go on and get your second dose. Because I do believe that the supply will increase. I mean, we're in a bad place right now. We have 450,000 or so that are vaccinated in this state, less than 1%. But let's get them fully vaccinated. And then as other vaccines come online, as the supply increases, we can catch these other individuals.
Given what the mayor said, that at this rate, people in L.A. won't be fully vaccinated for 5 years. As you say, there will be more vaccines and more people will get vaccinated. But where do you think we'll be, let's say, 6 months from now? Will we have enough people vaccinated in 6 months from now, do you think?
So there are a couple of factors. One, which we've discussed, is vaccine hesitancy. So I want someone to write that off. But that we can control as best we can. But looking at things that we truly can control, which is the supply, the allocation, distribution, and the vaccination, I think it's not going to take that long. I really do believe that as this gets ramped up, more doses will come into L.A. County, and there will be, therefore, more availability of those that want to get vaccinated to get vaccinated. And I think that once the people see that people are getting vaccinated, they're going to want it too. People want what they don't have. So right now there's a desire, I think, to get it. So no, I don't agree with the mayor. I think the mayor was, I understand, I think he's frustrated. And we all are frustrated. I understand where he's coming from. But we will have more vaccine. I'd say in 6 months we will have a fair amount. I can't say what the percentage is, but more than what he was predicting.
All right. Dr. Oliver Brooks, co-chair of California's Drafting Guidelines Work Group and chief medical officer of Watts Healthcare Corporation. Thanks for coming back on the show today.
All right. Thank you very much, Madeline, for hosting this forum.
Coming up, did President Trump break the law in that phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State? The Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Find the votes. That was the order President Trump gave to Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in an hour-long phone call over the weekend, pressuring him to reverse President-elect Joe Biden's win.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
Trump also hinted at criminal charges if Raffensperger and his aides didn't follow through. But the president is the one who may have committed crimes here, both at the federal and state level. Here to talk about this is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Well, Happy New Year.
Oh, happy calendar change to you, too.
Exactly. Doesn't feel very new at all. But anyway, what did he, just ask you the question straight up. Did the president commit a federal crime here?
I think it's very likely that he did. And I'll tell you the only reason that I'm hedging. But the federal crime here would essentially be election fraud, which, of course, ironically, is what he has claimed happened. And there's been no evidence of that. So it's a federal crime to knowingly and willfully deprive or defraud or attempt to deprive or defraud residents of a state of a fair and impartial election process by either obtaining, casting, or counting ballots that you know are materially false. I listened to the conversation. It sure sounds like that's what happened, but what's the potential get out of jail free card here? Astonishingly, the defense is if the president really believes the lies, the falsehoods, the conspiracy theories, then he isn't able to rise to the level of intent that you need. The prosecutor couldn't prove that he knew that this was materially false. The prosecutor wouldn't be able to prove that he acted knowingly and willfully.
How can you know that? I mean, that's like you'd have to read his mind.
Yeah, well, this is why these particular statutes can be hard to prosecute, but you have to infer it unless you have somebody who says, I know this is wrong. I know I'm committing a federal crime, which, of course, nobody ever does. Then you have to look at objective circumstances. You have to interview the people in the room, ask what the discussions were before, after the conversation. But in this case, it really is, I think, astounding that the question mark is the president, in my view, so detached from the reality of what the Department of Justice said, the FBI said, every state and federal judge who has looked at this issue has said, which is no voter fraud. Is he so detached from that that he wasn't able to form the requisite criminal intent here?
Interesting. Well, what about on the state level? Is there a different level there where he could actually be prosecuted?
Yes, there is potential state criminal exposure here under the Georgia Elections Code. Particularly, we're looking at criminal solicitation to commit election fraud and election fraud itself. And the reason that that's important isn't because you would want a, you know, so-called belt and suspenders approach, but if the president tries to pardon himself, which if we had talked about this 2 days ago, I would have said, not going to happen. Now I'm not so sure. If he tries to pardon himself, that would only cover potential federal crime. So I think it is really significant that there's potential criminal exposure under the Georgia Elections Code.
Well, so how would that work then? They would have to prosecute him, I guess, after he left office. And is that something that's doable, prosecuting a former president in a state court?
It is absolutely doable. I mean, this becomes then a question of, do we have the political will to do it? But there is that old legal maxim, and I know it might sound naive at this point, but that no person is above the law. And that includes no former president of the United States. So this is norm breaking. It's something we haven't seen before, but there's nothing constitutionally that would prohibit bringing charges, either federal or state, against a former president. And that is absolutely something that I think federal prosecutors could look at. And Democrats have already asked the FBI to start an investigation. And we already know that in a separate case, the New York Attorney General and the New York District Attorney are looking at different potential criminal charges involving the Trump organization and businesses. So yes, we could see that happen.
Right. But that was for behavior that took place before, as well as during, but before he took office, right? I mean, this would be behavior he took as sitting president.
Right. And there are issues of presidential immunity, but I don't think that they would reach this particular behavior. And in part, if it did, I mean, you can imagine the slippery slope that that would lead to. It would essentially allow presidents to try and undermine the electoral process in order to stay in power and insulate themselves from criminal exposure. It would be this kind of horrible feedback loop. And I don't think that this is what presidential immunity is designed to protect. Presidential immunity is designed to make sure that presidents can make decisions without constant fear that they're going to face liability, not protect them against, frankly, violating criminal laws.
Well, meanwhile, Congress is scheduled to certify the election results this week on Wednesday, and at least 12 Republican senators and more than 100 members of the House, GOP, say they will challenge Biden's win in a few states. So just react to that. What does that actually consist of? I mean, it isn't in part an empty gesture because it's not going to succeed. But what could it do? What could it succeed at doing?
Well, undermining our faith in our system of self-government, which is obviously desperately dispiriting and problematic. But in the short term, I do want to tell people, none of this will change the outcome of the election, and none of this will prevent President-elect Biden from becoming President Biden on January 20th. You might be really excited about that. You might be really upset by that. But none of what we're going to see in the joint session on Wednesday is going to change that outcome. Now, typically, Madeline, you know, you and I would never talk about this procedural deadline of Congress counting the electoral votes. It's something that just comes and goes. And the Vice President of the United States, as President of the Senate, presides over a joint session, and he basically opens an envelope. He says, count the votes. And then he says, any objections, which usually gets as much reaction as, you know, at a marriage ceremony. And if anybody wants to say something, say it now or forever hold your peace. And nobody says anything. And typically in the joint session, nobody says anything. But in this case, we know people will say something, they'll object, and members of the House have found senators to join them. It will lead to 2 hours of debate on, then they'll vote on the objections, and this could drag out the process, but it couldn't undermine the process in the short term. Of course, the big questions are long term, what kind of precedent does this set?
Exactly. And could Mitch McConnell shut it all down and say, we're not going to have this in the Senate, we're not going to have this long debate? Because we know it's going to fail anyway?
No, I think he tried pretty hard to say to his caucus, don't join in the objections. But it's clear that at least one senator is going to join. And under the Electoral Count Act of 1887, a particular sentence even I didn't expect that I was going to be uttering, but under the Electoral Count Act of 1887, it's pretty clear that Mitch McConnell can't say, take it back. I don't want to do this. We all know what's going to happen, that it does trigger that there would be this 2-hour debate. And, you know, again, I think it will fail. The numbers aren't there, but it is interesting how close we came to using these laws in a way that maybe wouldn't have failed and would have undermined. And there have been, you know, also there's been objections by Senator Cruz saying he wants a 10-day audit. That's not envisioned under the current law at all. You would have to, I think, pass a superseding federal law. So I suspect this is all about politics and that people know there is an illegal route here.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she's our regular legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Black Lives Matter movement in the new year.
It takes people of courage and people of vision to say it doesn't matter if you're ready, this is what's right.
Absolutely. We are never getting justice on schedule. People don't like the phrase defund the police. They hated the phrase abolish slavery, but it was the right thing to do.
Where the BLM movement goes from here, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 2020 was a year when this country looked in the mirror and stared down some ugly truths about systemic racism, not just in law enforcement, but pretty much everywhere, from healthcare to schools to book publishing. The deaths of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Dijon Kizzy reignited the Black Lives Matter movement. It first formed back in 2013 after the killing of Trayvon Martin. Well, now, some 7 years later, where is it headed? Two guests join me now to talk about what's next for Black Lives Matter. Melina Abdullah is an organizer with the movement, and she's a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Peniel Joseph is a historian at the University of Texas at Austin and founder of the school's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Melina, let's begin with you. Looking back on the past year, it was a year of a lot of activism. What are you most proud of when it comes to that?
Well, you know, one of the things that we say often is that when we fight, we win. And 2020 was a year of immense struggle when people understood that we were not just facing a health pandemic with an economic fallout, but there was an ongoing pandemic that steals the lives of Black people at the hands of the state. And people weren't willing to let that struggle go, even in the midst of the health pandemic. So right here in Los Angeles, we've been engaged in a 3-year-long fight to oust the district attorney who had basically signed off on the murders of 628 people at the hands of law enforcement. And we were able to get Jackie Lacey out of office. We were able to usher in what we call a people's budget and a reallocation of dollars away from police and towards the things that actually build safe communities. We were able to pass Measure J in LA County and pass Measure R earlier that year, the Reform LA Jails measure. And so there's a lot of work that was done. And of course, we always say that Black folks got Donald Trump out of office, and Black folks are continuing to hold our elected officials accountable.
Hmm. And Peniel, what about you? Looking at it from a national perspective, where were the gains made in terms of activism, in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, yeah, I echo everything Melina said. I think the gains were made in a panoramic way. First, BLM has argued that the criminal justice system in the United States of America represents a panoramic gateway to multi-dimensional systems of oppression that are connected to race, class, gender, sexuality, and require intersectional justice at the local, at the state, at the federal level to be transformed. So that means not just criminal justice, but public school education. It means mental health. It means homelessness, the maternal death rates for Black women. It means all those things. And it means thinking of public safety less as systems of punishment and incarceration and the willful and systemic murder of Black people, but public safety as something that nourishes communities. And so at the national level, even something like the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, even though it didn't go far enough, that was not going to be on the table without BLM. And then at the local level in cities like Austin, Texas, where I live, you saw police budgets reduced. Here it was by 5%. But this idea of defunding the police to reimagine public safety became something that was tangible. And we saw in Los Angeles and other places budget reallocations that were really, really tangible. So I think that BLM really became in 2020 the conscience of the entire nation, and it at least started and jump-started not just a discussion, but policy transformations and very impactful reallocations of budgets at the state and the federal and the local level in ways that are really transformative.
I wonder, though, as we're seeing violent crime increase, especially when it comes to shootings here in Los Angeles, we haven't seen numbers like this in many, many years, if that's going to, I don't know, change the conversation when it comes to reallocating police budgets. Is that something that you're thinking about right now, Melina?
Well, it's really important that we listen to history, that we remember that anytime there's an economic downturn and we're in a state of economic crisis in Black communities, that you're going to see an increase in crime. The way that we get at crime, I think, is really remembering what the long-term solutions are. So what we need in communities, again, is mental health resources, is housing, is support for our young people who are transitioning into this online learning, which is absolutely terrible for their mental health without the support that they need. And so we need to make sure that we invest as we divest from over-policing that puts targets on Black people's backs. We need to invest in the things that actually benefit community.
But do you think that people will have as much enthusiasm for defunding the police now when they see crime levels on the rise, especially violent crime?
Well, I think we can. It depends on what we share. It depends on, you know, the way in which things are pitched to them. If we allow police narratives that police are the solutions to everything, that police are the solution to homelessness, police are the solution to a health pandemic, then people will, you know, go along with that. But if we open up this idea that the answer to a health pandemic is more healthcare, right? The answer to an economic crisis is more resources. And we've seen that work in places like Newark, New Jersey, where Mayor Raz Baraka is investing in community solutions rather than over-policing.
And are you satisfied with the way that's going here in Los Angeles?
Well, absolutely not. And so one of the things that we're pushing for with People's Budget LA is making sure that we hold the mayor and city council accountable. They pledged to cut $150 million from LAPD. The mayor pledged to add an additional $100 million, so a total of $250 million that's supposed to go into Black communities and other marginalized communities to really develop long-term solutions. So we have to hold them accountable. Black Lives Matter and People's Budget LA Coalition wrote a letter last week to the mayor asking for some accountability. We know that he vetoed the city council's plan to spend only in the things that the city was already doing, and he challenged them to be more revolutionary. We are saying that's a great approach. We want to be revolutionary with you, and we need to make sure that we engage in those investments.
And Peniel, what do you think that incoming president, Joe Biden, what should he be prioritizing when it comes to this? Is there something concrete that he can do to change things right off the bat?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think what Joe Biden should do on day one is, through executive order, launch a national racial truth, justice, and healing commission. And that should have a congressional liaison. It should be run out of the White House by Susan Rice, his domestic advisor, or the vice president. And what that would do is really, one, truth and justice are needed before healing. People talk about healing in the aftermath of the 2020 election, but we need truth about our history. And we can see this with the debates over the 1619 Project, which was pushed back against by President Trump with the 1776 Commission to have sort of this white supremacist vision of American history where slavery wasn't that big of a deal and the rape and sexual assault against Black women weren't that big of a deal. And the destruction of Black bodies wasn't that big of a deal because people don't want to understand the truth. And so if he sets that up, we get the truth, but then you also get justice in terms of designing policy implementations that go beyond what we're doing right now, because everything that we're doing now doesn't work. So what Biden can do with the National Racial Truth, Justice, and Healing Commission is, one, tell the truth. We need to be honest with each other about the history of white supremacy in the United States and the way in which it grotesquely disfigures our democracy and destroys Black people. Two, design and implement new strategies for not just anti-racism, but racial justice. What Dr. King talked about with Black citizenship was not just ending racial oppression, but was decent housing, universal basic income, healthcare for all people. And then three, you're going to get the healing once you get the justice. And that presidential level commission should be working with local and state and federal authorities, because at the local level, people are doing reparations commissions at the local level. People are trying to change city charters at the local level. This is an all hands on deck situation. And the best thing Biden can do is use the presidential bully pulpit to coerce, to prod, to inspire, and yes, shame people into doing the right thing, because we could use more shame in this country in terms of to coercing people into doing the right thing. That's what Dr. King tried to do. It wasn't all inspiration. He said at the March on Washington that the state of Alabama and Mississippi were filled with vicious racists and segregationists. That's Dr. King, right? So he was trying to shame people into doing the right thing in addition to transformative policies.
And I just love what Dr. Joseph is saying about transformative policies, right? So we've been stuck in a place where we've been having conversations around reform of fundamentally unjust systems, right? So rather than tinkering around the edges of a fundamentally unjust system, we need to be much more imaginative about what justice means, what safety means, and how we engage. And so Black Lives Matter and the Movement for Black Lives has written a policy proposal called the BREATHE Act, which is a transformational approach to public safety, a transformational approach to what this world should look like. And I think that it's far time, it's beyond time that we engage in these kind of conversations about transformation.
Do you think this is the moment to do that? I mean, do you think that people are broadly want to hear this, or do they, given the activism of the past year, or do they still need to be, well, educated, to put it nicely?
Well, I think, and Dr. Joseph, please weigh in on this. I think that what you're saying, and I agree with wholeheartedly, is people are never ready to hear it. Right? Yes. You know, people weren't ready to end slavery or segregation or usher in rights for women or talk about Black power or ethnic studies. They're never ready for it. It takes people of courage and people of vision to say, it doesn't matter if you're ready, this is what's right, and let's move based on what's right.
Absolutely. We are never, ever getting justice on schedule. People don't like the phrase defund the police. They hated the phrase abolish slavery, but it was the right thing to do. And so the only way we're going to get change is if we have the fierce urgency of now that Dr. King said. There's no correct slogan, no matter what President Obama or any critic of defund the police says. There's no nice way to get justice in the United States of America. That's what Frederick Douglass taught us. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and never will. We have to force the change that we know is the morally and politically correct thing to do right here, right now.
Well, thank you both for coming on the show today. Really appreciate your words. Peniel Joseph is a historian at the University of Texas at Austin and founder of the school's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Melina Abdullah is an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement and a professor at Cal State Los Angeles.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having me.
It has been 40 years of the punk band Bad Religion. Coming up, a conversation with two of the founders, one of whom is an evolutionary biologist by day. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the early 1980s, LA's underground punk scene was at its peak. Bands like Black Flag, The Germs, and X brought in huge crowds of sweaty teens to their shows. But a lot of these punk groups were never able to pivot from the underground scene to mainstream success. Bad Religion was an exception.
Let's talk about no one. Please talk about no one. Someone, anyone. You and me have a disease. You affect me. You infect me. I'm a
Religion became mainstays on K-Rock, making their music a soundtrack for disaffected suburban youth around L.A. And they just celebrated 40 years together as a band. Originally, they were going to honor the anniversary with a world tour that was canceled for obvious reasons. Instead, the band just finished an online streaming event where they played songs from their four decades together at the Roxy on Sunset Strip for nocapshows.com. They also released an autobiography. Joining me to talk about those last four decades are two members of the group, Greg Graffin, singer and co-founder of Bad Religion. He's also a professor at Cornell University in New York. Welcome.
Thanks.
And Jay Bentley is bassist and co-founder of the band. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. All right, well, let's talk about that song, because the lyrics, "You and me have a disease, you affect me, you infect me," I guess that's pretty relevant these days. What was it originally about?
This was one of the few love songs, I think, that we ever wrote, believe it or not. And Brett, who wrote the song, is not here tonight, but he's probably listening to this and saying, yeah, that was one of our departures, because we've never really written a song about an infected love relationship. So I always wanted to do an album of love songs, but it never came to fruition. That was about as close as we got. Yeah, Jay's going, this is the first I ever heard of this.
I did not know this.
You don't really think of punk rock and love songs in the same sentence.
But maybe that's a good reason to do it.
So you guys were going to celebrate this 40-year anniversary with this giant tour this year, but in April you decided not to play any shows. And that was pretty early on, because a lot of people, including big, you know, like Coachella and places like that, didn't think 2020 would be canceled entirely back in April. What went into your thinking about that decision?
Do you know what Greg is studying in Cornell?
Yeah, evolutionary biology. Is that right? Greg, did you see it coming?
It was clear that once the news started saying this thing is now community spread, it didn't really matter what the numbers were. It was going to be out of control. And yes, we had some degree of control over it as a population doing social distancing. But in general, if you look at the history of these kind of interactions on an evolutionary scale, it's very hard once something is community spread like this to eradicate it. So that only is sort of the background information that we talked about. We had more serious discussions about whether or not we wanted to be responsible for bringing our fans and audiences together in the midst of all of this. And it just didn't seem like a very wise thing to do. And then, you know, so very quickly then the recommendations of the CDC and World Health Organization, they made the decision for us, because they were just, it was a world tour we had planned, and all around the world, they were essentially banning concerts.
Take us back 40 years ago, and when you first started the band, you guys were actually making music out of your garage, right, Greg, in Woodland Hills?
Well, Jay lived in Woodland Hills, Brett lived in Woodland Hills, but we lived across the street in Canoga Park.
Ah, okay.
He's from Canoga Park, we don't talk.
Now, if you know anything about those neighborhoods, which I'm sure you do, because you're in, even though Santa Monica is where KCRW is headquartered, I believe, but it's a little bit more of a, well, you know, even Santa Monica, you cross 26th Street and you leave West LA and you're in Santa Monica. All of the neighborhoods in Southern California are basically a street. And in our area, it was Victory Boulevard. When you go across Victory, the house has changed slightly, but not really. And then you're in Canoga Park. And those are the areas of LA that have miles and miles of endless garages in the back alleys that seem to stretch on for mile after mile of similar garages. And yep. one of those was my mom's garage. And she was with the only mom who could tolerate it because she was at work all day. And I mean, we tried it at Jay's house. I think it lasted 2 hours before the police came.
That's right. One time.
And then my mom, she said, as long as you're done by 6 o'clock, because that's when I come home from work. I think we ended up having to stop at 5 o'clock because yep. the neighbors raised hell. Yep. And that became our hangout after school from about 2:30 to 5 o'clock every night. You could find us there, sometimes rehearsing and quite often just hanging out with whoever made the trek. You know, there weren't many punk rockers in the West Valley at that time. And our garage served as a hub for whoever wanted to come by and hang out for rehearsal.
Did you know any of the other bands in the scene at the time? Were you just kind of doing your own thing in the garage?
Hmm. We became friends with them as we became more of a band, but I don't think we knew anybody. I didn't know anybody.
No, like we did not have a lot. We didn't really have musical connections. We were very eager to make friends with other bands, but there simply were no other bands that far outside of Hollywood or Los Angeles proper. Orange County had a very thriving scene, but it was only a very rare instance that anyone from Orange County would come out to the West Valley. Some of our, you know, fondest memories were when we did get to know bands. We used to be friends with the Adolescents, and Jay got to know TSOL and a lot of the guys in Orange County bands. And of course, they never ventured out because there were no clubs out there, but there was one place called the Valley West Concert Club. And one night, Agent Orange was playing there. And I think Steve Soto may have still been in the band or he was playing with them or something. And those guys came and hung out at our rehearsal before their gig, because the venue was only 2 miles from our garage. So that was a real thrill.
Well, Agent Orange was the name of my first car. So that's bringing me back. It was an orange Datsun. So there you go.
Wow, that's cool.
Bringing me back. Okay, well, let's hear a little bit from your first record. This song is called We're Only Gonna Die.
Early man.
Greg, is that the early evolutionary biologist speaking there?
Actually, that's very accurate and observant of you. That song was inspired by a quote, really, at the end of Richard Leakey's book called Origins, which was a book that he put together to detail the history of the human species. And in fact, the title, We're Only Gonna Die from Our Own Arrogance, comes from the last line in the book. And the last line in that book says something about how, you know, our species is not immune to extinction. And to have, you know, arrived on this planet as the most intelligent being, to go extinct so quickly would be the ultimate arrogance, you know, or something like that. And so I said, oh, well, we're only gonna die from our own arrogance.
Well, I guess looking back at your 15-year-old selves, how do you feel about that? I mean, do you think, wow, that was pretty advanced for a teenager to be having these thoughts?
Well, I mean, knowing Brett and Greg the way that I do, the answer to that is no. Only because I know other 15-year-olds that weren't reading the things that Brett and Greg were reading and talking about things, whether it was quantum physics or religion. There wasn't really anything that we didn't talk about. I've just said all of my education has come from being in this band. And so it's never seemed odd to me. I guess it seems odd on the outside, but that just seemed who we were.
There's not many people in this world who look back at their teenage years as their greatest accomplishment. That's kind of an indication that you haven't really matured or you haven't done much with your life. So we've continued to, raise raise the level of the discussion. Like Jay said, we talk about everything, and we've continued to write better music and get better as musicians. And that to me is more of an accomplishment than anything we achieved back when we were teenagers.
Yeah. Well, before COVID, but in the recent times, are the audiences different? Are young people different now when they come out to see you?
Very much so. Punk rock has gone through a lot of different phases. There was the time where you had to wear the right band shirt. You had to wear the right jacket or pants or shoes. You had to fit the form. Nowadays, you see people, all sorts of different fans of music. Punk rock has become part of the music lexicon. It's no longer just thought of as, a dirty underground secret. It is just part of rock and roll. It is part of music. So you can see someone with a Germ shirt talking to someone with a Foo Fighters shirt, and that's just normal now at a concert.
Well, is something lost with that, though? Because punk rock, at the time, was people saw it as a dangerous form of expression, right? And as we just discussed, in some cases it was, and with the physical violence and all, but it was really anti the status quo, the Reagan era, the Thatcher era. And now, if it is more part of the mainstream, does it lose its power to effectively critique the mainstream?
Well, I think you should ask yourself, what's an effective criticism of the mainstream? Is it more effective if it's just 16 guys hanging out in a garage and everyone is agreeing with one another? Or is it more effective criticism if it's heard on every major radio station in the world? I think you have to look at it as what's being said rather than the label you're slapping on the type of music. So it's a real accomplishment, I think, when Bad Religion gets played on the radio, because we really don't water down our message. We don't try to talk down to people just to get something played on the radio or to broadcast it widely. We believe what we have to say is still relevant and still interesting. If that's picked up by commercial radio, that's a real windfall. It means, wow, we're going to actually get this message heard.
When all soldiers lay their weapons down, or when all kings and all queens relinquish their crowns, or when the only true Messiah rescues us from ourselves, it's easy to imagine.
So are you hoping that in this coming year, maybe towards the end of this coming year, the end of 2021, you'll all be able to get together and actually play a live show in front of a live audience?
Well, hoping. But, there's always these ifs. And the if here on this one is large, because it involves liability. And, everybody wants to go have fun, but no one wants to be responsible. And that is the big question as far as putting on a concert and having people show up. At what point does anyone take responsibility for anything that may occur? And that's how we got here now, was Greg and I had that discussion about we're responsible people and are not going to subject our fans or their families to this issue. And the same thing will stand in the near future. They'll probably put shows out. Tours may happen and bands be out on the road, but what will happen when one of the members of the band gets sick, or one of the crew gets sick, or the merch guy has COVID? those are questions that are going to have to get really well answered, not just like, well, you know, sort of answered. They'll have to have a definitive answer before bands can really go back out on the road and play shows.
Well, until that day, we have all your records to hold us over. That's Greg Graffin and Jay Bentley, two of the founding members of LA punk band Bad Religion. Tonight's your last chance to catch their streaming event. More info at badreligion.nocapshows.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
I love your show. When the hills of Los Angeles are burning, palm trees are candles in the murder wind. So many lives are on the breeze. Even the stars are ill at ease. And Los Angeles.
And that will do it for the first show of the new year. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.